Hello, this is Lewis.
And this is Ian.
And welcome to 101 Films You Should Have Seen.
Probably.
Yes.
When will we ever have that? I mean, because I was waiting for you to say something like you do every single
time. I know.
And so we just was in silence. One day we're just going to say the damn title of this podcast and then just move straight on.
Okay, so this week we're doing The Third Man.
Yes.
One of the greatest films of all time.
Mm.
Apparently.
Apparently. Interestingly, it was on a list in the late 90s as being the greatest British film of the 20th century.
Really? And above Love Actually.
Above Love Actually.
Wow.
I know, it's hard to get your head around. Above Zardoz. Above.
God, Zardoz.
Incredible, isn't it?
Is there going to be a podcast we don't talk about Zardoz?
Not from now on. From now on, I'm going to try and get him in there.
The brutal is in the fourth hour of unconscious sleep.
Incidentally, out there, if you do want to follow Zardoz on Twitter, he has got his own account. And he's mentioned us, so thank you, Zardoz, whoever you are.
Well, thank you.
Zardoz. Oh, he's Arthur. Already I'm forgetting all the names. Anyway, let's not get bogged down in Zardoz. Yes, it was the greatest British film ever made of the 20th century and the 57th best American film, apparently. Yes, the Americans, because one of the producers was American, took it as their own.
Well, I suppose it does feature mostly American actors. Well, no, actually, Trevor Howard. Come on, Trevor Howard.
Yeah, exactly. And it's directed and produced. Yeah, it's essentially a British film.
Yeah, it is. Made by British Lion Productions.
Exactly. And then you got the damn Yanks coming over here, taking our films and our women.
Oh, dear.
Anyway, so, yes, The Third Man.
Yeah, so the story behind this is Ian got me this for Christmas.
Yeah.
As a film that neither of us have seen.
They'll know that because they would have listened to our 101 Films Christmas special. And
that's
when
true.
We opened up our DVD Christmas presents.
Yeah.
They'll remember. They love us.
Yeah.
They love us.
Well, actually, that's, funnily enough, is actually our most popular podcast, the Christmas special. So.
Wow, what a disappointing Christmas so many people had.
Well, we were quite drunk during that Christmas special.
I guess lots and lots of people got the podcast for Christmas.
Yeah.
That's what it is.
That's exactly
definitely.
It, yeah. I couldn't afford much this year, so I got you a podcast.
It is the gift that keeps on giving, though, isn't it? So, a subscription to 101 films you should have seen, probably.
We should do gift vouchers. Anyway, so what's the pitch?
The pitch. I'm thinking.
It's a tricky one because the trouble with this film is it's a film noir and it's basically a kind of murder mystery, I guess. Hmm. And it's really difficult to talk about it without actually giving away any of the plot details for people who haven't seen it.
Okay.
So we're going to try our best not to give it away.
Okay. All right. An American arrives in post-war Vienna and finds out more than he bargained for about one of his close friends.
Yeah, that'll do.
Yeah.
That'll do.
And hijinks ensue.
I was waiting for you to say that.
Yeah, so very basically, we have Holly Martins, a kind of...
pulp novelist.
Yeah, pulp novelist, writes westerns, that sort of thing, arriving for a job, which had been set up by his friend Harry Lime. And when he arrives, he finds out Harry Lime's been dead, or has been killed, or is dead. And so he's kind of slightly suspicious of the circumstances, so decides to start investigating.
Mm, there are some contradictions surrounding his death.
Yes, so he gets called up and he meets his Harry Lime's gal, Anna Schmidt.
Miserable Anna Schmidt.
An actress.
Does she crack a smile in the whole film?
A little bit later on, Holly references her smile, doesn't he? Because the first time I've seen you smile. And I think that's the last time.
Yeah. Apparently one of the producers wanted to make her more glamorous in the picture, but the Carol Reed, the director, resisted.
I think it works quite well, her being quite miserable. Anyway, his investigations are both hindered and helped by Major Calloway and Sergeant Payne, both parts of the British police slash army.
Yep. It's quite an interesting setup because I didn't really know about this, but in Vienna, in a similar way to Berlin, the city was partitioned into the Russian sector, the British sector, the American sector and the French sector.
Yeah.
And it's kind of outlined at the very beginning of the film. The four great powers. Great powers.
Well... Two of them were. Britain and France were just allowed to join in.
Yeah. And so, yeah, it's. I didn't really know that happened. And again, if I analyse at the beginning of the film that the police force is made up of kind of patrols of a representative policeman from each of the four powers.
Well, there are sectors. The city, just similar to Berlin, divided into four sectors. But the difference between Vienna and Berlin was that Vienna had the centre of it was declared the international sector, and that sector was governed. They basically the four powers took it in turn to govern it. But as you say, it was policed by units comprising of one representative from each of the four powers.
What hijinks must have ensued in that?
It sounds insanely bureaucratic, doesn't it? But I guess that was the delicate balance of power just after the war. It is very interesting. It's well worth reading up on it if you don't really know much about it.
Yeah, it's very interesting. I mean, the film's basically set at the start of the Cold War, really. And you can see, you know, how it's the city's basically been divided up amongst the different powers and how it's going to go. And at one point, the main what's her name again? The main character, Anna Schmidt, she's threatened with deportation to the Czechoslovakia.
Yeah.
And, you know, kind of goes, the tension is there.
Yeah, yeah. It's to do with the Soviet Union. Yeah, it is. It's very, I suppose, just like our last film, the Daily Airport Fight was an interesting glimpse of Fleet Street in the early 1960s. This is a really interesting glimpse of post-war Vienna. Because, I mean, it was recorded literally just a few years after the war, wasn't it? made a few years just after the war. It was released in 1949, so I'm guessing it was filmed probably, 1948, 1947, so...
That's it, yeah, and all the way through, I mean, it's very prominent, the bomb damage in Vienna. It's basically a city that's been decimated and is under reconstruction. And, yeah, it's kind of, it's almost like another character in the film, the actual
yeah,
city.
Yeah, definitely, yeah. No, I would totally agree. Well, speaking of characters, I'll just very quickly run through the characters and who they're played by. The main, I suppose, the Holly Martins, the man who's investigating Harry Lime's death, is played by Joseph Cotton, who I've never heard of before.
Is that
embarrassing?
You've never seen Citizen Kane?
Oh, I have, yeah. But
he's like the main guy in Citizen Kane.
Did he? Is he? I can't remember. It's been several years since I've seen
it. Okay. Well, basically, he's been in all of the Orson Welles films.
I didn't recognise him. Yeah. I don't. What part did he play in Citizen Kane?
He was the...
Was he
was the report. It was the reporter, wasn't he? Oh, it's been such a long time since I've seen.
What was he like? Charles Foster Kane's mate at the paper.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, the guy when Kane takes over, when first buys the paper and he gets his mate in to help him. Is that him?
I think. So. Oh God, this is embarrassing. I've forgotten all this.
Oh well. The people do not tune into us for hard
facts.
Hard facts. They tune in for us, me and you, going, oh God, what's his name? What film was he in? What did he do again? Just so they have the pleasure of shouting at us, you idiot. It was...
Well, I do know that Joseph Cotton was an actor who Wells worked with in theatre, and then he brought him over to to the film. And yeah, he worked with him on Touch of Evil and Magnificent Ambersons as well, I think.
I wonder if he was in the theatre that... Because Orson Welles was quite heavily involved in the... here we go.
War of the Worlds?
I forgot. No, well, no, the, oh, yeah, well, not War of the Worlds. No, the theatre... There was a theatre company set up essentially under the New Deal.
Oh, right.
And maybe I'm totally making
this up. I love this stabbing in the dark. We're just stabbing in the dark for facts. Where are the facts?
I know.
The facts are here somewhere. Where are they? Are they under here? No, they're not here.
Can you imagine if in the future our podcast is the only record of, like, film? And certain future historians are trying to piece together 20th century, 21st century film. They're like, okay... We're not quite...
So Joseph Cotton was like a mate of Orson Welles, and he was in some of his films and stuff, but we don't know much more about it apart from that. Ian's not really sure who he is.
So that's Holly Martin, that's Joseph Cotton. Moving on, we've mentioned him several times, Harry Lime, the recently deceased Harry Lime, played by Orson Welles. The love interest, Anna Schmidt, is played by, it's just Verley. That's how she's...
Verley, she's just billed as Verley.
Verley. But I think
she's the Madonna. She's just one word.
Yeah, she is the Madonna of the 1940s. And I thought that was very
miserable. what's her name? Alida Valli.
Alida Valli, I think. And then Major Calloway, played by Trevor Howard.
Trevor Howard.
You're just going to say their names. And I think probably my favourite character of the whole thing, Sergeant Payne, played by Bernard Lee.
He's good, isn't he?
I like him.
You better scarper.
Just when he just hits Holly Martin's sort of Holly Martin's getting a bit drunk, a bit rowdy, and he just goes, "Oh, come on, sir," and then clocks him.
It's not really a punch. It's
and then helps him up. Goes, "Right, come on then, sir."
It's more of a biff, I'd say. It's not really a punch. It's a biff.
And there are obviously several other characters, but I'm just going to throw him in there. I'm sure we're talking about him a little bit later, but. One person I feel stand out for both of us was Krabbin. The kind of cultural attaché, I guess.
Yeah, the one who's organising the entertainment for the locals.
Played by Wilfred Hyde White. And we'll talk about him in a bit, but yeah, it's a nice little performance.
Memorable.
But directed by Sir Carol Reed, and of course written by Graham Greene.
Yes, that's true.
Graham Greene.
Yes.
Now, Lewis, you're an English student. Yes. Tell us a little about Graham Greene.
Okay, well, most famous for...
He's drinking wine.
Oh, God. This is just a ruse to get me to talk while so you can have a sip of wine.
It is.
Oh, Graham Greene. I've only read one of his novels, which is Brighton Rock, which was the only novel I've ever read where I thought it would be better as a film than a book.
Well, funny enough, I read the novella of The Third Man while on a trip to Finn. I think I've mentioned this in a previous podcast.
Possibly. I wasn't really paying attention. I generally don't listen when you talk.
No, I don't either. And there's getting too many now to listen to.
Yeah.
Like, when we only had like two or three, I could listen to them. But now...
Well, you listen to them after we recorded them?
Yeah, to listen to again.
Just
now,
a bit of bedtime. You know,
Still, it's on my list of things to do is to sit down, listen to them, to write all the trivia questions. And I've listened to
the first
three.
Who's winning
three.
The trivia quiz.
Yeah, exactly. It's a mystery, isn't it? I've listened to the first three, and now we're like, what's this? 15? 16?
Don't even start.
No, I mean, this is 16. Oh, it's just too... We're getting too many now. It's just too much. That's almost... Probably works out something like 12 hours of us just rambling about nonsense.
But it's interesting. It's entertaining.
Mm, to us, perhaps. Anyway, so...
Well, enough for you to listen to it again.
So, I read the novella by Graham Greene. And actually, when I went to Vienna, just to kind of get a... I bought it in a second-hand shop just before I went. I was like, oh, this would be quite a good thing to read. As a, while I'm in Vienna, sort of feel part of the city. And the thing is, when you in the introduction to it, Graham Greene just says, well, I only wrote this to get the film made. It was told that, and the actual novel wasn't published until after the film came out.
Yeah.
It more or less follows the broad plot of the film. But as you said, it's written to be made as a film. I don't know what, Brighton Rock was like, but certainly it really felt like it was just laying out. Yeah, I suppose it's just very visual.
It's interesting. I've never seen the Brighton Rock film, or films, I suppose there's two now.
Surprising, really.
But I do remember reading it and thinking, this would be a better film.
Any of the Quiet American films?
I've seen The Quiet American with Michael Caine and Brendan Fraser, which is very, very good, actually. Have you seen that one?
No, I haven't.
Maybe that's another one for the podcast, but yeah, it was really, really good.
Oh, okay. Yeah, so to Carol Reed, fantastic direction.
Very good. I only recently found out that he's not a woman.
Yeah, that would... Look, I mean, if he had been a woman, it would have been fantastic. But for one, directing films in the late 40s, getting a sir, getting a knighthood.
Hey,
the first woman ever to be...
Who am I to question the Queen's judgment? Could have been an awful mix-up down at the palace.
I'm thinking now, as I said, this is their 16th one. I'm forgetting what little stories we've told on these podcasts and what we haven't.
You're an old man now.
You forget what you said. Yeah, already, yeah. Have I told you the story? I've probably told you this. When I was working in Vancouver, I saw an invitation for... I was working in a business school there, for the university there. And I saw... an invitation for a dinner and a list of local dignitaries and various people. And one of the people invited was Sir James Bond.
No!
Yes! Someone called James Bond.
No!
And he was knighted Sir James Bond.
No way! I wonder what the Queen whispered in his ear as she was raising the sword.
I suspect she knighted him because she thought it was James Bond. You've saved this country several times. Arise, Sir James Bond.
In honour of your protection from this country, from Blofeld and Scaramanga.
Tell me, did he really have a third nipple? Can I see your license to kill? I hope so, anyway. Unless they just got confused. It was actually Roger Moore, was going along. And
I dub you Sir James, but my name's Roger Moore.
But, Mom, they're essentially the same.
Yeah, he would have been pleased with that, I think.
He would have been, yeah.
He could have been called Sir the Saint.
Sir the Saint, Sir the Saint, yeah. Sir Carol Reed's. It's great direction. Reminds me a little bit of Batman, the TV series, just because of the angles.
Well, it's very reminiscent of Citizen Kane, all the camera angles and the kind of crazy lighting and all that kind of stuff. There was lots of rumours.
Yeah, I was about to say.
That kind of Wells actually kind of directed parts of it or anything like that. But I think those rumours were scotched by Wells himself many, many years later.
Yeah.
But you can see Carol was obviously influenced by the earlier kind of Wells films. Because, the skewed camera angles and all that kind of stuff, you don't really get many films like that of the time or even now, I guess. Except Batman. Batman, the 1960s series. Influenced by Wells.
Influenced by Citizen Kane. I think you're right there. It still looks slightly jarring, unusual, even to modernise.
Mm.
It's certainly not something you've gone, oh, this old kind of... It's not a cliche. It still looks quite unusual and fresh, even now.
I can see, from a kind of cinematographer perspective, then this is a really interesting film to watch. It's very unique in the way it's presented. Mm. And yeah, I think...
Fantastic use of shadows.
Yes,
lots of focusing
on that.
People's shadows.
Yes.
Yeah, really, really good. Like, often you can't see the character, you can just see their shadow.
Yeah.
And following that shadow as it runs along a road or something like that. Mm. Yeah, really, really good. Very, very, as I say, even now, still quite, still stands out and still catches the eye. Shall we get the trivia quiz out of the way?
Let's do the trivia quiz.
We're trying to get, I've noticed recently, we're doing these earlier and earlier and earlier, just trying to get them done.
Because
obviously we don't want to.
Otherwise, we do end up talking about the quiz questions. So,
trivia!
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 I've got some doozies for you tonight.
Doozies?
Yeah.
That's an interesting word. All right, so, Harry Lyon... we've already mentioned the novella that Graham Greene wrote to get the film made. The characters of Harry Lyon and Holly Martin are different in one big fundamental way.
Okay.
Between the book and the film. And they both have the same difference. What is that difference?
I think I know this one. It's that... In the book, they're both British, but in the film, they're both American.
All right. Okay. Now, Holly Martin is, as you said, a bit of a pulp fiction writer. One book in particular is mentioned several times. It's used as a signifier for Holly to meet one of Harry Lyon's friends. And a little bit later, Major Calloway mentions that he's reading it. What is the title of that book?
Oh, I know this. The Oklahoma Kid.
All right. And finally, history question for you, Lewis.
Okay.
The Four Powers ran post-war Vienna. When did they leave?
Oh, what? That's a harsh one. When did they
leave? If you know your history.
Right.
What year did they leave Vienna?
What day is it? Oh, okay. I'm just going to say, it's a complete guess, 1955.
All right.
Right.
Your questions, please,
My
Lewis.
Questions. Okay, here we go. First question... Name another Graham Greene screenplay that was directed by Carol Reed.
Oh, dear me. Okay, I'm going to say Brighton Rock.
Okay. This is about Orson Welles. So Orson Welles, famous that we talked about him already, played Charles Foster Kane in Citizen Kane. But who is Charles Foster Kane widely believed to be based on in real life? Who's the real life character that Charles Foster Kane is widely believed to be based on?
William Hurst.
Okay. And last one. What was Holly Martin's first name in the novella?
Rollo.
Okay. All right, that's it.
All right, okay, so your questions. Harry Lyman, Holly Martins are different in one main way. Obviously, you mentioned another way. Holly has a different first name in the novella. But you're right, they are both British in the novella. The title of Holly Martins' book is Oklahoma Kid, correct? And finally, when did the Four Powers leave? You said 1955. The correct answer was 1955.
Yay!
3 out of 3.
That was a complete guess as well.
Well done.
I just thought, about 10 years after World War II. Bam!
All right, okay.
Okay, how did you do? Name another Graham Greene screenplay directed by Carol Reed. He actually directed 3 screenplays by Graham Greene. One was The Third Man. The other was Our Man in Havana. Or you could have had The Fallen Idol. Who was Charles Foster Kane based on? William Randolph Hearst, you're right.
Yeah, that's annoying because I've got the other two right.
Yeah. So. And yeah, Holly Martin's first name was Rollo or Rolo.
Rollo, depends on how you pronounce it. Yeah.
In the novel.
Ah, okay. Well, you won this. You won this one.
I can't believe I got 1955.
Yeah, good guess. Damn you. Damn, I thought that was a banker. Well, you definitely wouldn't get that. Damn it. Anyway, so, we talked a little bit about post-war Vienna earlier, but what I found absolutely, I guess it was on purpose, but I suppose they only just used what there was in Vienna. I just found it so interesting how so many of the sets and the rooms and the buildings are just really opulent and really over the top.
Yeah,
you know, there's so like columns and really luxurious, but they've got bullet holes in them.
Yeah,
and they've got, you know, piles of rubble right next to them, and or windows aren't there, and yeah, little things like that. And
I loved Anna Schmidt's flat. She's got the most amazing flat. It's like enormously high ceilings, these ornate decorations. But like you said, it's kind of all peeling and kind of decayed.
Yeah,
but you could see it was once amazingly opulent.
Well, I guess all those cities were perhaps not so much the capitals, but a lot of those cities were just depopulated, weren't they? So many people were either, you know, dead or had not got back to the city yet, or, you know, missing, or, you know, there was just so much more room. There would have been huge stretches of the city just which were just empty.
Yeah.
I guess, yeah. I remember reading about Alan Wicker in post-war Venice. And he was just saying it was just absolutely amazing because, you know, obviously there was no tourists at all. You know, it was quite quiet and just locals, and other than the occupying military force, it was just, you know, one of the amazing times to see a city like that.
Yeah.
You'd never have that again.
Yeah, that's it, yeah.
And, a real interesting glimpse to what Vienna was like. Just little sequences where you see some characters just walking down the streets and in the background you just see, you know, half-demolished buildings or bomb sites, really kind of paints that picture of just a city, as you say, recovering from the war.
Exactly. There's a great sequence where Holly Martins kind of hides in a burnt-out car to try and evade his pursuers.
Oh, yeah.
And that's just fantastic. Just the fact that there was a burnt-out car, you know, 4 years after the war or something, just in the streets, just to show the amount of devastation.
Well, like there's quite a few several chase scenes or moments where they're running through rubble, or there's that the staircase that's used like 3 or 4 times when characters go down, and half the staircase is just like sort of cracked, and you know, so they kind of had to awkwardly kind of climb over the bit which isn't, you know, which is sort of been broken up. Great they get there, and also of course it was just recorded so close. Filmed so close to the end of the Second World War.
It's not a documentary.
No, I know. That's what I keep thinking of it in that sense. Just because I think it's just capturing that Vienna. Well, within 5 years was gone. You know, once the Four Powers are gone. Yeah, you know, it was such a peculiar moment in in Vienna's history and in European history.
So what do you think the strongest bits of the film?
Well, towards the end, there's an amazing chase sequence through the sewers.
Yeah, it goes on forever.
It does. It's a slightly too long, but some of the shots in that of just those huge spaces. I think quite a few European cities have that. I think Paris has really wide, open sewers.
Yeah.
And it's just incredible. Yeah, it's just the use of shadow and darkness and night and the rushing water and the light reflecting off the water against the walls and stuff. Really looks
and the sense
amazing.
Of tension, you know, it really builds it up. It's great. I think a lot of those sequences were actually shot in a studio in Shepperton. But I think some of it was actually filmed on location, but I'm not quite sure which bits. But yeah, it's interesting.
Yeah, and I suppose another strong bit is at the Ferris wheel.
Oh, the Ferris wheel. I was going to say that. Yeah. Amazing sequence. Can't really talk about it without spoiling the film.
No.
But it is a really, really powerful sequence. Yeah. And if you've watched the film, you'll know exactly what we're talking about. Definitely the best bit of acting in the film.
Certainly. And I think the discussions they have there and...
It's difficult to say. I know what you're thinking. It's like, oh, you know, I want to say what they say, but I really don't want to give away the film. So.
Well, there's a great speech made about people in it.
Yeah.
And just saying
and,
like,
and Switzerland.
And Switzerland, too. But looking down, just saying, look at the people, you know, would you, if I get, you know, look at them, they just look like dots from down here. If I offered you £20,000, which I thought was interesting. He says £20,000 rather than $20,000. Bit of an overhang from
the screenplay,
But yeah. It says £20,000 to kill, you know, if I gave you £20,000, all you used to do was get rid of one of those dots. Would you do it?
Mm.
Yeah, trying to kind of justify some pretty amoral or immoral behaviour and actions.
Mm.
I guess that must have been... even more of a beginner issue, so just at that time, because obviously they were dealing with, you know, the Nuremberg trials and trying to come to terms with what people managed to do and how brutal they managed to be to each other. I suppose, in a strange way, though, it's even worse when it's just for profit.
Yeah,
There's no more belief in it than that.
There's no greater good. It's,
Well, you can't even fool yourselves into thinking that you're doing something right by doing something. It's just... pure greed and profit.
I tell you what thing about this film is that it really lends itself to discussion. Like, now that I've watched it, I keep thinking about more things. I'm like, oh, what about that bit? You know, I want, you know, that's...
Shame we can't talk about them on here without spoiling.
I know, it's really hard, you know. If any of you want to just come round and we'll just chat. Be fine. No one's seen it. What is the, just, you know, shoot the breeze with...
I think maybe when we finish this list of films, we should go back and we'll record like 3 or 4 specials where we just talk about... endings of films. Then we'll do spoiler casts. Maybe we should do that perhaps once every kind of like 15 or 20 podcasts. We'll just do a quick update spoiler cast.
Yeah,
we'll just
don't listen.
Spoilers from that's several it. Films. From.
Don't listen if you want to watch the films.
I think it would just end up being a list of me and you going, and that happened. I just wanted to say it. It was so incredible. And it turned out he was dead all along.
I see dead people.
It's his dad. It's his dad.
Oh dear. So that's his sister? Ooh.
Best not to think about that. Yeah. So another strongest bit, and it actually appears in the trailer that we saw, is the music of Anton Karas.
Oh yeah.
Which has in the trailer. It must have been quite famous at the time because they make a big
This is in lieu of ukulele challenge.
Yeah, because before we watched the film, I said, "Oh, it's got." Lewis said, "Oh, you're going to do a ukulele challenge." I said, "Oh, unfortunately, we haven't got it with me. We're recording this on a Friday night.
I know.
That's what we've been
rejecting. Madness.
And I'm dressed in a suit because I've come straight from work. Lewis,
I know. We've taken it out market this week.
I know. I mean, Lewis is dressed in what he normally dresses in, a slightly stained vest, tracky bottoms, and flip flops. But I'm here.
Chucky Bobs.
Yeah. All right, he's not wearing trousers. But, whereas I'm in a suit, and yeah, I've made an effort. But anyway, so Yeah, so I didn't want to bring the ukulele around, but I did say, oh, you'll know the music from the film, though. And you were like, oh, will I? And then as soon as it starts, you're like, yes,
straight
I've heard
away.
This before. This,
it's, if you've not seen the film, you will totally recognise the music.
It's been used several times. Yeah, in lots
I'm sure, of I think it's even been on an advert. So.
Yeah, almost certainly.
Definitely.
Yeah. But I think it seemed to be quite, I don't know, it just seemed to be quite a big deal back then, because they mentioned it in the trailer, and the great line, he'll have you in a dither with his ziver.
Because it's played on a ziver.
Ziver, yeah.
But, yeah, it's, yeah. I don't know, it's weird, because a lot of people talk about the music in the film, and it is very, very striking music. Hmm. Does it fit with the film? It's a bit weird.
I think it does, because I think common to actually quite a few people of films and entertainment and ideas and books made by the post-war generation, they were slightly arch, they were slightly ironic, they were kind of giving a knowing glance when they did it, because they'd all been sent off to fight and all told, it's for the greater good, it's this, it's important. They kind of knew that, but they also just thought, oh, here we go again. Yeah, we're having this war, which the war before this was never, you know, that was supposed to be the war to end all wars, and then 20 years later we're doing another massive one. And I mean, they kind of came away from the experience with a certain sort of, I mean, only once you live through something like that can you kind of be a little bit mocking of it. A little similar to Catch 22.
Yes.
When I was, what really surprised me, or what really struck me, was how dismissive they were of the Second World War. We're kind of, you know, it was the good war, it was the actions of the greatest generation. And obviously not to do down anything of the sacrifices that generation made, but you forget that generation actually probably at the time were like, oh God, Churchill banging on about this and that, we see it in very black and white terms and heroes and villains, where of course they were just people living through, you know, an extraordinary experience, but it was just people. And how would we deal with stuff like
at the
that?
Time, pretty much everyone would have known someone, a relative or someone who had died in the First World War, and then to be sucked into another World War, they must have been pretty...
I think also it's just a very healthy attitude. I think, you know, obviously we've not had anything, we've experienced nothing like that. But, you know, we've been in London when there have been terrorist scares or terrorist attacks. And how do people react? They just kind of, within a couple of days, people were joking about it. Laughing it off. And.
But it's interesting because, I mean, this film, I all I'd heard about it was it's kind of like a... kind of film noir, so I was expecting something kind of really cagey and nasty and dark, and actually the music kind of lends this kind of light-hearted quality to it, which is really...
To be fair, reading the novella, I got that impression as well. I think the music represents what the story was trying to achieve. I don't think obviously if you put some really dark, horrific music over it, it would change the tone of the film, but I think what Graham Greene wanted to achieve, and I'm guessing what Sir Carol Reed was trying to achieve, and probably Orson Welles and the rest of them, was that kind of slightly arch tone.
But it does go to show what an amazing effect music has in the film, because as we were watching it, I was thinking, what if this had different music? It would completely change the film.
Isn't it perfect music for Orson Welles, though? It's perfect music for him. It's definitely, when you see him in the film... Just his face, the moment when you sort of see his little kind of half smile face, and you think it just suits him perfectly.
That is Harry Lime.
He should have just walked around with that music just his day to day. I think Orson Welles was just like that as well, from what I understand as well. So
apparently, he turned up 2 weeks late for the shooting.
Well, he was already. He was quite a difficult person to work with. Although, from what I hear, he was one of the better ones to work with on. That was actually going to be my fourth question.
I said
three, but I did have one emergency one. What connects an emergency, like smash the glass for the emergency question? What connects this film with our previous film?
Day of the Earth Caught Fire.
And James Bond features in the connection.
Trevor Howard was chosen to play James Bond.
No. Obviously, Val Guest directed a little bit of James Bond, Casino Royale, and Orson Welles was in Casino Royale playing. What's his name? The French poker player.
I want to call him Lestat, but it's not.
It's not Lestat. Isn't that the.
Interview with the Vampire. I know the one
Lestrade, isn't he in. Is he Sherlock Holmes Lestrade, I think. Oh, Le Chiffre. Again, people at home going, oh my God, why do I listen to
this? Why do I bother? Why do I bother with this rubbish?
Sandra, turn it off! Turn it off! I don't want to hear it anymore.
I'm unsubscribing. I go to iTunes now. Unsubscribing.
But then he goes, oh, bless him. They're only just two boys mucking around. We'll download one more.
Give him another chance, love.
Yeah, we're actually very popular amongst most East End public houses. We're often played on a... They don't play us on a Thursday, that's silly. They wait to a Saturday night and then stick us on.
Just bang it on after Chaz and Dave.
Just after match of day finishes, and yeah, it's just the post football crowd are in, and they just sort of stick on us.
Right. I think we're blowing our own trumpets a bit. They probably just put us on in the toilets or something.
Maybe, yeah. Or just last orders, stick the podcast on this face to face.
I'll get out.
It's just awesome. We should just have that music. He should have just had that wherever he walks, just walking down the road. No, yes, Casino Royale. He Le Chiffre, whatever it is. But apparently in that film, he just kind of got on with the job, and it was old Peter Sellers who was just being an absolute maniac all the way through it and really playing up. Whereas Orson Welles just was like, I think actually Peter Sellers refused to be ever in the same room as Orson Welles, because I think he was
terrible. Did he owe him money?
No, I think he was just frightened that Orson Welles would steal his limelight. It was that, kind of slightly depressing.
He was an odd character, Peter Sellers.
He was, yeah. Perhaps we'll talk about that if we do the Pink Panther. We'll do a Pink Panther or something. Do you have a great idea for a movie? The way I asked that.
Well, I'm glad you asked. Is Kurt going to make an appearance today?
Okay, we'll see what your idea is if we need Kurt to step in.
Okay, well, I was thinking recently there was a remake of Brighton Rock, another fantastic Graham Greene film. And there was also...
Yeah, he's back!
He's back!
Good onboarding the friend, listeners. How nice to meet you all.
It does make me laugh, Kurt.
Yeah, okay, so...
So, I was thinking, about time we remade The Third Man.
Okay.
Right? And recently, we all know Orson Welles, one of his greatest roles was...
Never seen any of his films. Never seen it.
Well, you might have seen this one, Transformers the Movie, where I believe he played Unicron.
I know where you're going. Megan Fox as Harry Lime. I like it, Lewis. I like it.
Not quite. I was thinking more a remake of The Third Man, but featuring the Transformers. So we'd have probably Joseph Cotton's character, Holly Martin's, played by Shia LaBeouf, the great acting force that is Shia LaBeouf. And then obviously Anna Schmidt would be Megan Fox. I was thinking Trevor Howard's character, Calloway, would probably be a good fit for Optimus Prime. Or possibly Hot Rod. Possibly Hot Rod, I'm not sure. Payne, I'm reckoning, probably Bumblebee. Yeah,
yeah, Bumblebee. You're with me. I love that guy, I love him.
And I think, obviously for the villains in the piece, Popescu, a really good fit for, what's his name, Megatron. And his sidekick, I forget his name now.
Soundwave.
No. Kurt went out of the room for a second.
So he wasn't sure. So I was just, it's Soundwave, isn't it? Yeah, cheers. Yeah, Soundwave.
Yeah, Soundwave. I'm not quite sure who Starscream would be though.
Harry Lime.
You've hit the nail on the head right there.
That's why I'm in the biz. Give me Starscream's agent.
So is it a green light?
Yeah, green light. Green light.
Yes.
Thanks, Kurt. I actually I like the idea of Vienna being divided up between Autobots and Decepticons, and with just in the middle, the international sector being patrolled by a Russian, a French person, a British person, an American person, an Autobot, and a Decepticon. Imagine Grimlock and. I'm trying to think of a...
Mixmaster.
Mixmaster. Okay. Show me your papers. Says here you are from Cybertron. Is that correct?
Oh dear. We could also get Orson Welles to voice Unicron. Just kind of, I don't know, there might be a bit, a kind of cameo
role.
It
would get confusing though, wouldn't it?
It would get. If a giant planet turned.
Yeah, it would. Man, I'm going to make that. Let's make that film. Kurt, what do you think?
Yeah!
He's a thumbs up. He's just fallen out of a window. He did a thumbs up as he fell. So, brilliant. Excellent.
Good. I'm glad you like that one. It was a bit better than the last one.
Yes. So, do you feel there are any weak parts to this film? Is there a weak part?
Weak parts. I did feel it sagged a little bit in the middle.
Hmm.
And I felt that the mystery, the kind of whole mystery thing, was almost forgotten about. About halfway through. I can't really talk about it without giving stuff away.
Essentially the mystery's solved, isn't it?
Yeah. It's kind of like, you kind of led down all these kind of different paths. Well, all this intrigue is kind of
It won't be spoiled. So the mystery is discovering who the third man is.
Yeah.
And you, halfway through the film, you just, well, it's interesting because I read the novella, and so I knew exactly what was going on, and I knew the revelation halfway through. And so it just made me, like, at the end of the film, like, so who was the third man? And I was like, oh, right, well, they tell you halfway through the film, don't they? And I was like, okay, actually, it's not made particularly explicit. I suppose you are left to kind of make certain logical leaps and make certain guesses of your own.
It's not spelled out for you,
basically. No, it's not.
You do have to kind of
think. No, I suppose not.
Which is why I found it a bit hard.
A bit difficult. You were wondering where... what's his name? Mix-a-lot.
Mix-master. There's a great line in one of the... I remember watching this when I was a teenager, I think. There was an old Transformers cartoon rerun, and there's a great line in it where we're featuring Mix-master, who, by the way, is a mixing kind of... concrete mixing lorry.
Was he Autobot or Decepticon?
I can't remember. I think it was a Decepticon, actually. But anyway, there's a great line.
It was a truck, surely. It suggests he was an Autobot.
Anyway, there's a great point where one of the Transformers demands, Mixmaster, we need acid! Which is ripe for mixing into...
I was going to say, isn't it strange that there's not been... you'd have thought that would have just been on loop on one... You know, they still do it, actually, you know, in a club or a bar or during a dance floor. They just show, like, TV, old bits of films on loop and they're just on projection. And you'd have just thought they would have had that.
Surely that would be in a Europop disco... tune.
Yeah.
By now. Sort of techno tune.
I'm quite taken by the idea of Grimlock just
wandering around Vienna.
In his robot form, not his dinosaur form. Yeah. I'm not being stupid.
God, what idiots.
I suppose it does take some. I suppose I had certain ideas based on the novel of how Holly Martins or Rollo Martins or Rollo Martins is. And Joseph Cotton didn't quite fit my preconceptions of what the character was going to be like.
Okay.
So I did sort of, I wasn't massively into his, it was a very good performance, but I don't know, I think my own preconceptions hurt there. So I wouldn't even say it's a weak thing. It's my weakness, Lewis. I'm the weak one here. I didn't have that so much with Harry Lime, because I knew Harry Lime was played by Orson Welles when I read the book. Mm. So I just pictured Orson Welles all the way through.
I guess so.
So he fit it perfectly, because obviously he is Orson Welles.
I would say, though, that when Orson Welles makes his first appearance, it is amazing.
Mm.
He completely captures your imagination, and you're just kind of riveted to the screen.
Yeah.
And I remember when it first came on, I was just thinking, oh, I wish he was in the film more.
Yeah.
I wish he was in the film more.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah, he's used well, though.
Yeah,
he has a presence even when he's not there. Mm. Yeah, he dominates the film by his very absence, if that makes any sense. So would you recommend the film, Lewis?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. I would approach it with... I had kind of misconceptions of it as kind of a really dark kind of thriller. But it's not at all like that, really.
No.
Approach it with an open mind is what I would say.
It deals with some pretty dark material, dark subject matter.
But in a very light-hearted way, quite...
Yeah. I don't know, light-hearted is perhaps more... I suppose more of...
The villain... What I'm trying to say is...
The actual crimes are kept at a certain distance from the characters involved. It's not so much light-hearted. And in fact, that is part of the film, actually, trying to break down that distance.
Mm.
Trying to say, this lovable rogue is actually responsible for some pretty grim stuff.
And you
try and confront with them that. Mm-hmm. And yeah, it's interesting that we are despite that, we're still sort of slightly bowled over by Orson Welles' very charming performance.
Well, not just that. I mean, like, audiences were obviously wowed by him because they made a radio series afterwards.
Yes, they did.
The Adventures of Harry Lime.
Very much an anti-hero, isn't it?
Yeah.
But he is.
There was like a 52 episode radio series with like just Orson Welles narrating the character of Harry Lime.
Yeah, it does show that, and yeah, the crimes that character is actually responsible for are really horrific and really grim. Yeah, we still can't help like him. Still can't help love him.
Well, one of the best anti-heroes out there.
Yeah, I guess so, yeah. I suppose what sort of probably what the modern anti-hero is based on. Slightly shady past. Though the difference is most anti-heroes in modern films tend to come good in the end, whereas this one doesn't at all.
Nope.
There's no redemption whatsoever. There's not actually a glimmer of him going, oh, actually, deep down he was right. No, he's actually worse than what they actually think he is.
So I
certainly would recommend it. I think it's a fantastic film. Really, really good film.
Yeah.
Two good films in a row.
Yay!
What was the film before that?
Daily with Cupfire and The Godfather.
Oh, three good films in a row.
There we go. And then Zardoz. Which I still think you should watch, just because it's so bizarre.
To be fair, dear listener, you're not going to get pretty much any reference from the rest of this podcast series unless you've watched Zardoz, so you might as well. He's going to crop up a lot, I imagine.
It's like, gaining entry to a gang. You have to watch Zardoz to be entered into the podcast gang.
Yeah. Oh, dear. I just love the idea. I mean, London, reading a little bit about how gangs are becoming quite a bad thing in London. an increasing
good
problem,
thing before?
An issue in London, an increasingly bad issue in London. I just love the idea of one gang just forcing its members to watch Zardoz. If you're going to join us, you're going to watch this
film. Podcast gang.
Well, it would be great, though, if they did do that, and then whenever they needed weapons, they just go to a big mock-up of Zardoz and they just vomited guns like it does in the film.
In Clapham.
Oh, who are you mugged by? Oh, I was mugged by Zardoz.
You just spat a load of guns at me.
Right, okay. So...
So yeah, if you've got any films that you'd like us to watch, please email us at 101filmsyoushouldhavesseen@gmail.com.
And you can also go to our website at 101films.wordpress.com. And from there you can follow us, follow the links to us on Twitter and on Facebook. Do join us, do tell your friends. In fact, if you actually are one of our friends, can you tell our mutual friends also to listen to us? The amount of people, I just go, oh, and of course, I do the podcast. I'm like, do you? I'm like, I put a link up every week on Facebook.
They've probably blocked you on Facebook.
There's the sad truth.
Are they really your
and
friends?
Now we get to the nub of it, to the issue at the heart of a lot of
maybe
my
Facebook's
problems.
Blocking you. It could be.
At last.
Yeah. They found you out.
Anyway, so thanks.
That's it. Next week. Bye.
Bye.